Hello, everybody. Welcome to Super Together. It is the podcast where a couples therapist and a life coach slash alligator wrangler talk about how to be better at relationships. I'm James Cochran, and I'm the couples therapist. And across from me is Ginger Rothis, and she's the life coach slash alligator wrangler. Ginger, what are we talking about today?
We are talking in our series of five personality traits. We are on neuroticism today.
Yeah, and if that sounds like an outdated word, I think it probably is an outdated word.
It sounds like it could be like a dirty word,
like,
or
hysterical,
or
you know,
neurotic. I know.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah. So just to fill you in, so the last 4 weeks, this is the fourth of the last, the last 4 weeks, we have been talking about the way that these kind of high-level personality traits show up in relationships. We've covered agreeableness, we've covered organization, we've covered introversion, extroversion. This week we're on neuroticism. Next week we're going to be talking about openness,
okay.
Openness to change.
Good.
So when you think of neuroticism, what do you think of? Like, what does it inspire in your mind?
Yeah, I think the word neurotic comes to mind, and I think about kind of like unpredictable behavior, maybe unstable, emotional, but I'm saying those with a negative context, as if neuroticism is a bad thing. And I don't think, like all of our personality traits, we talk about the spectrum. And so I would tend to think, and James, is it right that secure and confident is at one end and sensitive,
yes,
and nervous is at the other end of the spectrum?
Right.
Okay, so secure and confident versus, or at one end, and sensitive and nervous at the other. So yeah, I guess neurotic would be that overly sensitive, mm-hmm, nervous, unsettled kind of human behavior.
Sure. And then maybe the secure and confident end is like the prototypical old white guy. You know, just somebody who's got no beef whatsoever about what's going on in their own experience. And, you know, and I say that to sort of characterize it in that negative frame, which,
yeah,
again, I think that we're used to characterizing overly emotional in a negative,
mm-hmm,
frame.
Right.
And so in reality, like, if you are dominated by one of these dimensions, then yeah, it's going to be harder to have success in relationships. It's going to be harder to feel, you know, healthy and balanced a lot of the time. And that's true in any direction, on any, whether you're, you know, organized to a fault or disorganized to a fault, that's going to create disruption. And same way with this particular spectrum. And I think part of the reason why we name that is because of all of them, neuroticism is the one that is easiest to sort of call out as negative, both in its name, but also in the way that our culture views emotionality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which as a woman, I'm a little sensitive to, too, because, mm-hmm, we've been told as women, you know, that you are overly sensitive,
mm-hmm,
or don't cry at work, or don't share your, you know, kind of your,
yep,
feelings aren't important. I think society, we're slowly embracing this, that emotions are not all bad,
right,
in our society and in our, especially work settings, are,
yeah,
really coming to mind. I remember as a little girl, you know, being told, like, don't let them see you cry, and toughen up, and don't,
mm-hmm,
wear your feelings on your sleeve. And it was my dad trying to help me, right, succeed in the world. And so it was as I got the message, like, oh, okay, being overly sensitive is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think there's some conditioning that happens too, and we are slowly as a society learning to embrace that emotions are messages and emotions are helpful indicators of, you know, from our minds to our actions,
mm-hmm,
of like, here's a message you need to pay attention to. Like, I say tears are truth a lot in my,
mm-hmm,
practice, because, you know, it's like when you start to feel emotion, you open up to something bigger. So yeah, I think as women, this word might be a little triggering in that we've been told that being sensitive is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think for men, we're told that as well, maybe with slightly different overtones, connotations. It is more like it's okay for women to be emotional,
yes,
but it is not okay,
exactly,
for you, male, to be emotional. And I've got a number of men that I work with, men that are part of couples that I'm working with, who just don't feel like they have access to their emotional world, who anytime emotional content gets brought up in the space of a conversation, just kind of shut down. In fact, I remember one of my supervisors when I was in graduate school said, like, the easiest way to shut down the male partner in a relationship is to ask him how he's feeling. Wow. So she said, literally, so don't ask them that. So she said, ask them what they're thinking.
Okay.
Now, she said, as a clinician, you want to get to the point where you can intuit somebody's feeling experience by what their thoughts are.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody says, hey, this is kind of how I'm thinking about this issue, it's like, oh, well, that must feel like blank, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that just because it's not something that we've trained ourselves to use doesn't mean that we actually don't have emotional content.
Right.
And so I think that in the space of a relationship, where I see this show up most often is you've got one partner who is very sensitive, very attuned to emotions, and then you've got another partner who is less so. Now, sometimes you're at like extreme ends where one partner can cry at the drop of a hat and is very readily responsive to somebody's emotional experience, and then you have one partner who is just, you know, appears like a robot or presents like a robot in certain ways. But again, I don't think that means we don't have the ability to learn from each other, that we don't have the ability to understand how the other person is feeling. And so I think that that's what I want you and I to be curious about today, mm-hmm. is when we feel ourselves at odds with our partners in this way, what are the ways around that? How can we overcome what feels like that barrier to all you do is feel everything and I can't feel anything, or, you know, I don't have the ability to sense what your emotional experience is, and that's something that comes very easily to you. Like, what are the ways that we overcome that as a barrier to connection?
Yeah, I think you use the word tune in, and that's what's coming to mind as, like, really appreciating where your partner is on the spectrum. So I would say, like, Rob is probably more towards the secure and confident mm-hmm. end of the spectrum, and especially historically, I was much more at the sensitive, nervous mm-hmm. end. I think self-compassion and me learning it and teaching it has really helped mm-hmm. me kind of move more towards the middle, because I think a lot of my nervousness and oversensitivity was wanting to please people, mm-hmm. was wanting to get it all right, was the perfectionism tendency. And kind of learning to be okay with myself, to, you know, let myself off the hook for mistakes. Mm-hmm. I've noticed that has helped me probably move down the spectrum towards more confidence and secure, and more like doing the work of knowing who I am has helped a lot with that. But I think in relationships, if somebody is, you know, as at one end or the other, opposite of you, this tuning into why are they feeling the way they're feeling? Mm-hmm. How am I contributing to this? And I think for Rob, one of the things I was first attracted to was his sense of, you know, self-awareness and mm-hmm. his security, his confidence in himself. He was very self-assured, like, it's all going to be okay. Mm-hmm. While I was worrying about everything and trying to control the situation. We dated long distance for years, and that would always be one of his phrases of, like, it's all going to work out somehow. And mm-hmm. and I would want the, no, how? When am I moving? When are you moving? You know, that I was always trying to force it, nervous that it would end. So I think that for him, he was a stabilizing force for me, but I had to learn to appreciate that and not get frustrated mm-hmm. with it.
Yeah. I think, so Lindsay and I are pretty far apart on the spectrum. I think she probably wouldn't feel shame in me naming that, like, she has not, it's rare if she has a day where she doesn't cry once.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean that she doesn't have good days very often. I think she has great days, but I think that she is very responsive to the emotional reality that she lives mm-hmm. inside of. Whereas, you know, I cannot remember the last time that mm-hmm. I cried or mm-hmm. the last time that I had an overflowing emotional reaction to something. And honestly, like, I've been in therapy for like almost a year now mm-hmm. because I recognize that as a deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love that in the space of our partnership, I have the ability to be, hey, everything's going to be all right. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm not, you know, really stressed out about this situation. But at the same time, I recognize the challenge that it must be for Lindsay to have these emotional experiences that I don't always have access to. And also for me, not being able to not being able to fully respond to the way that the world unfolds around me outside of my kind of thinking brain, you know, the parts of my brain that are able to assess something and analyze something rationally, to really incorporate that other, you know, that other part of my experience. So tuning in, being attuned, which I think in a lot of ways looks like open and honest conversation. It is about incorporating, you know, our intuitive experience. So you can go back and listen to some of our episodes on intuition and kind of what that looks like. You know, it's not just the what somebody is saying, but the how somebody is saying it. One of the tools, so being attuned, I think, is one thing. I think that creating a capacity for commonality, like a shared vocabulary, I think is really important. So I cannot remember the last time I didn't give a couple a feelings wheel. Some kind of tool that allows them to get on the same page with what they're talking about. I think in the West, we are not given a very robust emotional vocabulary to talk about our own experiences, or really to talk about the experiences of others. What I find so interesting is that if I give somebody a feelings wheel, and I will put a link to that in the show notes, and what I mean by a feelings wheel is it is a, well, it's a wheel.
Well, it's like a pie.
It's a picture. Yeah, it looks like a pie. That's the best way to think about it. And at the center of the pie, you have like the big emotions, the anger, fear, joy, sadness, some other ones.
Surprise, I think, is on some.
Surprise. And so you've got these very easy to understand, easy to name, easy to experience emotions. And then as you work out from those emotions, you have more precise ways of describing feelings that sort of fall under that category. So the example that I give couples a lot of the time is if I say to Lindsay that I'm feeling angry about something, and what I mean is that I'm disappointed, but what she thinks is that I'm annoyed. Then we're both talking about two different things. Now she has, because she has a higher sensitivity, she's going to detect that discrepancy probably more readily than I can. So what's important is that we both know with precision kind of what's going on with our emotional experience. And I think that's where something like a feelings wheel can be really valuable. So when you get out the feelings wheel, it's a tool to help make more precise the things that you're saying. And what I love about it is it's not like a thesaurus. It's not going to give you emotions that you've never heard of. Like, you know what disappointed is, you know what annoyed is, and you know the difference between those two. But what's really, really hard is that we are not used to applying those labels directly to our own experience, especially in the space of a romantic relationship. And because we don't have that experience, because we were, I'll say we as men, but, you know, people in general, we're not really taught to cultivate that emotional experience. Now, I'll say for the record that I think we are going to see a very different generation that's coming up. Like, my kids have more emotional intelligence than I do. And I think it's just because from an early age, we, like, recognize now, like, oh, man, like, that is a really valuable thing to be able to know and understand, you know, what you're experiencing, what somebody else is experiencing. You know, so when Lindsay and I are reading books, we routinely ask them, like, hey, what do you think this character is feeling? What do you think that there is going on with them? And right now, yeah, they're probably just using the high level kinds of emotions, but we'll be able to add more nuance kind of as that goes along.
Well, and isn't it cool as a parent that the more specific the child is, the more you can help them or address what's really going on?
Yeah.
And I think that's true in relationships too. If I'm feeling sad, but I really identify that it's lonely and it's really betrayal, that leads to a much richer conversation than if we're just trying to read into what does sad mean for you.
Yeah, and different kinds of solutions,
yes,
different kinds
exactly.
of, you know, here's how we move forward with this idea.
Yes.
So we started with this idea of like, okay, be attuned to the fact that your partners, you and your partner are going to be at different places on this spectrum. And then in that recognition, get to a place where you say, okay, well, let's make sure that we're both actually talking about the same thing. You know, I think when I consider this idea of like neuroticism as like part of how it shows up in the Big Five, I think it has to do a lot with reactivity mm-hmm. and the ways that we absorb stress in mm-hmm. our environment. So you mentioned, for example, you know, mm-hmm. a stressor sort of falls out of the sky. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to look very different to Rob than it is to
That's
you.
Right.
It's going to look very different to Lindsay than it is than it does to me. You know, how do we help couples consider the way that that stressor shows up, the way that it, you know, triggers us mm-hmm. differently, the ways that it, you know, calls forth different things in us? Because it's one thing to say, like, okay, you know, we've been talking more about the sensitivity end mm-hmm. of the spectrum, like how in tune we are with our emotions. But there's this other space where we say, like, we absorb stress in different ways. And if you are more attuned emotionally, you know, I sometimes mm-hmm. encourage people to think about it as like you're a more sensitive smoke alarm.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So we have this one smoke alarm in our yeah. house that it doesn't matter if there is any amount of smoke that comes from our stove, and it's in Cora's bedroom, and it's mm-hmm. it's not the closest smoke
yes.
alarm, but and
anything.
It's, you know, we have vaulted ceilings, but uh-huh. somehow if you know, we leave the bacon in the oven mm-hmm. for 1 minute too long, we cook bacon in the oven because that's the best way to do
yes,
it.
Yes, I agree with that.
1 minute too long, that smoke alarm is going to go off.
Yeah.
And there's, we don't know much what to do about it. Yeah. It's just very, very sensitive.
Yes.
And then there's other smoke alarms that, you know, yeah. won't go off at all. And both of those are a problem,
right?
A smoke alarm that doesn't go off because it's like super, super
That's
secure.
Right.
It's like, yeah, nothing's ever a problem. Like there's going to be times when there is a problem
That's
and
right.
you need to be responsive. But if you're going off all the time mm-hmm. when, hey, yeah, there's smoke, but this is why this is a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a problem as well. So how do we help bridge that gap for folks?
I think in this idea of I'm not here to fix you, right? I'm here to help you get through life as a partner. Mm-hmm. So your way of reacting is not necessarily wrong. It is that how can I help you? So if you are a highly sensitive person and a stressor falls out of the sky, how can I help you deal with that? Not fix you or blame you for overreacting. Mm-hmm. So I think that we've talked about this on the other five traits of personality of to drop our arrogance that my way is correct mm-hmm. and your way is wrong. But instead, this is how we are wired. And how do I help you get through life as a partner that I love? And what do I know about you? So, you know, one of the things that I've noticed in my own life is that meditating has really changed my brain. And I think as we talk about neuroticism today, I think it's really impacted neuroticism. So where I used to go into a panic, I notice more clear thinking, a little calmer reaction, less reactivity probably. And, you know, so Rob will notice if I'm amped up again, he mm-hmm. will say, like, what do you need to do? Do you need to go on a walk by
Does
yourself?
He ever say to you, just like, go meditate, Ginger?
No. It's usually in the form of a question. Like, do you need to go to sleep? Do you think you need to go to sleep? Would now be a good time to go to bed? Which is code for, okay, I'm breaking down. I'm losing it. But I think that he's seen enough of what helps me, a good night's sleep, meditation, go for mm-hmm. a walk by myself. I'll take the kids and you go, you know, do what you need to do. So we have kind of learned that how to help each other. And I will have to say sometimes, like, I need you to worry about this with me. Mm-hmm. I need you to care. This is important. And so that kind of means to him, like, oh, all right, she's worried about this and we need to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I can't just be confident it'll all work out. That's not enough to help her. So the idea of not fixing one another and the idea of what could I do to support you given how you're wired.
Right. And I think what I appreciate so much in that is like the humility that it requires of saying that I don't understand everything about how this looks, but you know, you don't understand everything about the way that it looks either. I in my Converge course, which is available now at convergecourses.com, I use this example of the blind men and the elephant. It's an Indian parable of this group of blind men comes upon this elephant, and one person grabs the trunk and they said, oh, this is, I think they say, yeah, this is a snake.
Yeah.
One person touches the side and says, this is a wall. Another person grabs the legs and says, this is a tree. And all of them are wrong. But if they were able to honor the truth in not only their own experience, but the experience of the others, that's when you find some space of the truth. And you say, okay, I am likely to not be sensitive enough to the reality of this situation. You are likely to be too sensitive to the reality of this situation. As an example, we are we're trying to homeschool our daughters in the context of this global pandemic. And me being somebody, again, that's more on the stable, secure end of this spectrum, all this stuff is unfolding, I'm thinking, oh, great, we'll homeschool them. And Lindsay, not nearly as confident as I am that will be an effective solution. And I think, if I'm honest, I was probably too dismissive of her sensitivity in that space, because we're about 4 or 5 weeks in and it feels like we are crashing and burning. Wow. Like, homeschooling is really, it's really so hard. And you know, we've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. So it's basically we're kindergarten teachers for a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, because the 3-year-old is just around.
Yes.
And that is something where if we had probably had more in-depth conversations or more, let's really understand where each other's coming from in this. That's not to say that we would have definitely arrived at the right solution. It's possible that I could have convinced her, like, oh, no, here's all the reasons why this is a good idea. And it may still be a good idea. But I think what was probably lacking is, like, really open and honest conversations about, okay, your sensitivity is something I need to honor, because left to my own devices, it's possible that this is going to go somewhere that is actually not healthy for us, mm-hmm. or not going to lead to sort of the balance that we're seeking.
Yeah, I love that balance of when one partner is really confident about something and the other partner's not so sure. That's a good place for conversation too, because we want to honor, like, it reassures me that you're super confident this will work, but at the same time, what do we need to talk about, mm-hmm. or what might come up, without deterring from your confidence, but also saying, what will the challenges be in this? I'm glad you're confident that this could work and that you could do it, but maybe we should visit about what if this doesn't go well, or right. how would we, it's a contingency plan kind of around your confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that I think probably gets us to the end of our discussion on neuroticism. One of the things that I wanted to do was put a shout out to Melody Rowell, who is an audio producer and podcast consultant, and somebody who has been working with us to try to figure out how do we make our podcast more dope.
And dope is a good thing.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. Dope is a good thing. And so one of the things that we're going to be trying to doing is making our conversations a little bit more succinct, a little bit more, shareable, all that kind of thing. One of the things that we're, bouncing around is how do we engage our listeners a little bit more directly. And so over the next few weeks, you'll probably hear us talk about what that looks like a little bit more. And one of the things that I think could be really helpful to us is if you connected with us and let us know a little bit about, what you like about the podcast, what you don't like about the podcast, what would make it easier for you to share it with your friends, what would make it something that you would like to see to be able to be a little bit more engaged. I'm going to invite you to send those emails to me, and you can do that at james@talkingwithjames.com. Talkingwithjames.com, by the way, is my website, and you can find out more information about my practice there. Ginger, where can folks get in touch with you?
Yeah, and you can find me at compassionfix.com.
Yeah. So keep your ear to the ground as we try to make this, what we think is a pretty cool podcast, even cooler. That is all we've got for you this week. Ginger, you got anything else?
No. Be well.